This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. I'm Nabil Biagio sitting in for Yahir Wahib, and here's what's coming up.
Culture is an important lever of people's development. In this context, it is essential that women in general, and those from the Islamic tradition in particular, see it as an instrument of personal development.
That was Cameroonian Prime Minister Joseph Dion Gute, who chaired a conference on Islam, women's empowerment and peace building on how traditions affect development. Also, former boxing champion Floyd Mayweather Jr. is in Zimbabwe. And Tunisia's Ons Jabeur will play in her second consecutive Wimbledon tennis final tomorrow. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Leaders from 25 Muslim-majority countries in Africa meeting in Cameroon have called for an end to excluding women from political, social, economic, and religious issues in the name of the Islamic teachings. The consensus at the UN Conference on Islam, Women's Empowerment and Peace Building is that Muslim women who are the most affected by conflicts in sub-Saharan Africa should take lead roles in communities and decision-making. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Muslim clerics say they are launching a campaign on the African continent to counter stereotypes that impede the emancipation of Muslim women. More than 300 clerics, Islamic scholars and researchers from 25 African countries met in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé this week at a United Nations conference on Islam women, empowerment and peace building. Mamadou Lamine Diallo is a Muslim scholar and researcher at the Lansana Conte University in Guinea-Conakry. He says the Yaoundé conference that ended Friday reached an agreement. The campaign will begin in communities where some Muslim leaders teach and practice concepts that are strange to Islam. Mamadou says teachings that girls should be given to marriage in their teens, while women should leave social, economic and political activities to men, are misleading. He says in the Holy Quran 43:19, Prophet Muhammad, who is the founder of Islam, establishes complete equality between men and women. He says the fact that Prophet Muhammad's first wife, Khadija, was a highly respected business leader who traded in furniture, pottery and silks, is an indication that women should not be excluded from political, social, economic, and religious issues in the name of Islamic teachings. Mamadou said the idea that women should be allowed to carry out only domestic chores and farm work is an outdated African practice. He said Boko Haram has been using female suicide bombers since 2010 with false promises that when a woman dies while fighting for Islam, she immediately goes to heaven. Clerics say Muslim women constitute a majority of those enduring unprecedented levels of sexual violence, increased food insecurity, and displacement. Muslim women are the highest group of the 3 million people displaced by Boko Haram terrorism in Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon, and Niger, according to the clerics. Mariam Amsha is a female Muslim leader in Bamari, a commercial town in the Central African Republic, or CAR. She says exclusion makes Muslim women ignorant of their roles in building peace in that country. Amsha says it will be an abuse of democratic norms if a majority of the more than 51% of CAR's 900,000 Muslims who are women do not take part in expected elections because they have been taught to avoid politics. She says she is inviting imams to make sure that Muslim women are taking part in negotiations to end a decade of political tensions and develop CAR. CAR will be holding presidential elections in 2025. Mariam said a president elected by a majority of civilians including women, who are the hardest hit by sectarian violence, will be a major step to peace. CAR descended into chaos after longtime leader Francois Bozizé was overthrown in 2013 by a predominantly Muslim rebel alliance called Seleka. Cameroonian Prime Minister Joseph John Guti, who chaired the conference, says if not stopped, some religious beliefs will slow Africa's development.
Culture is an important lever of people's development. In this context, it is essential that women in general, and those from the Islamic tradition in particular, see it as an instrument of personal development. That is why the government trains citizens who are rooted in their culture, respectful of the general interests, and open to the world.
The Muslim leaders say if Africa provides greater impetus to Muslim women, high levels of poverty will be reduced and several million civilians will free themselves from the bondage of slavery caused by erroneous beliefs about Islam. Participants at the conference came from countries including Nigeria, Morocco, Libya, Algeria, Sudan, South Sudan, Somalia, Egypt, Tunisia, Mauritania, Chad, Cameroon, CAR, Guinea-Conakry, Niger, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
After years of failed talks, Ethiopia and Egypt said Thursday they aim to finalize, within 4 months, an agreement on the operations of Africa's largest dam, an apparent breakthrough in a dispute that Cairo has described as an existential threat. News reports say a joint statement on expedited negotiations issued by Ethiopia's government came after Ethiopia Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed discussed the hydroelectric dam with Egypt President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. They met on the sidelines of a regional meeting in Cairo discussing the conflict in neighboring Sudan. Sudan is a third party to the talks regarding the 4.6 billion Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam on Ethiopia's stretch of the Blue Nile, just 10 kilometers or 6 miles from the Sudanese border. Egypt depends on the Nile to supply its booming population of 100 million with fresh water. Ethiopia says the dam helps pull millions of its 110 million citizens out of poverty. Tensions rose as Ethiopia began to fill the dam's reservoir over the past few years. The new statement does not describe the foreseen agreement as a legally binding one, which Egypt and Sudan have sought. It also doesn't say whether the talks will be under the auspices of the African Union, which Ethiopia has preferred. Former champion U.S. boxer Floyd Mayweather Jr. is in Zimbabwe to promote the sport a year after making a similar trip to Nigeria. But in Zimbabwe, Mayweather also appears to be supporting the ruling ZANU-PF party to campaign for August elections. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, Zimbabwe.
Floyd Mayweather Jr.'s private jet landed Thursday in Zimbabwe, where he was welcomed and joined in dancing to African drums. The American former champion boxer told waiting reporters he was excited to be in Zimbabwe and back in Africa after his first trip to the continent in Nigeria a year ago.
It's always great to come back to Africa, the motherland, a beautiful place. Beautiful people, it's nothing like coming back and seeing my people. They embrace me with open arms.
Like Nigeria, Mayweather's trip to Zimbabwe was billed as promoting the sport of boxing. But his Zimbabwe trip is not without controversy. Mayweather attended a political rally Thursday for the ruling ZANU-PF party, which critics accuse of using authoritarian tactics against opponents and mismanaging the struggling economy. The 46-year-old former boxer is being hosted by Scott Sakupanya, a controversial gold dealer who is running for parliament in next month's elections on the ZANU-PF ticket. Sakukhanya in April was named in an Al Jazeera investigative documentary, The Gold Mafia, that exposed a gold smuggling and money laundering ring involving top officials. A convicted gold smuggler in the documentary named Sakukhanya as Zimbabwe's biggest gold guy, to which he has not responded. Zimbabwe Central Bank froze the assets of four men named in the documentary, and the government says it is investigating the allegations. Sakukhanya welcomed Mayweather to the ZANU-PF rally in Mabvuku, the Harare suburb where he is running for office. Mayweather is happy to be here, he says, and wants to come back again. He told me that people in America do not really know what is happening here, says Sakukhanya. He did not even bring his security details because he knows Zimbabwe is a peaceful country. He says this shows that foreigners should not talk about Zimbabwe before they come here. They must leave politics where it's not necessary. Sakukhanya gained public attention in 2020 when photos of him surfaced in social media posing with gold bars and millions of dollars in cash. Some social media posts criticized Sakukhanya for campaigning with Mayweather, who is also known for flashing wealth when most Zimbabweans are living in poverty. One of the critics is Tendai Biti, vice president of the main opposition party, the Citizens Coalition for Change.
It's obscene, it's immoral, and it shows the wrong priorities of ZANU-PF. I hope the residents of Mabvuku are wise enough and will vote for the right candidate in the plebiscite to be held in August of 2023.
Biti said Mayweather should be ashamed for becoming an implicit part of alleged illicit financial flows. When called by VOA, a designated media team for Mayweather and Sakukhanya refused to comment on the issue. The American boxer is expected to fly to South Africa Friday and then return to Sunday to visit Victoria Falls on Zimbabwe's border with Zambia before returning to the U.S. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. And as a reminder, VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th. Help us celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a particular news story that you connected with. Recall a favorite memory about VOA Africa, and tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. That number again is +1 202 258 3076, and thanks for 60 years of support. Sudan's capital, Khartoum, experienced a communications blackout for several hours today as the army and the paramilitary forces waged intense battles across Khartoum. Residents told the French news agency AFP that internet and mobile phone connections were out of service as violent clashes raged in several parts of the capital. The source of the outages was not clear, and some mobile networks were restored by midday. Also yesterday, a summit of African leaders from Sudan's neighbors urged an end to the fighting, as UN experts reported a mass grave had been discovered in the country's Darfur region. The summit also called on both parties to secure corridors for urgently needed aid. At a UN Security Council meeting last month, speakers urged member states to do more to counter the security threat posed by climate change. Meanwhile, in Chad, conflicts between farmers and herders from the Fulani ethnic group are flaring as warming temperatures further reduce already scarce water and usable land. Henry Wilkins reports from N'Djamena, Chad.
In the countryside outside Chad's capital, N'Djamena, farmers and herders say they have noticed the weather change in recent years. It's becoming more difficult to farm with less rainfall and hotter temperatures. The UN says usable land for farmers and herders is diminishing, a situation that intensifies conflict between the groups. Farmers like Abdul Aziz Mohammed says it has become necessary to build nearly 2 meter high fences to protect his crops from cattle. He says they built the fences to stop thieves and idling animals from entering the farm, particularly idling cattle. He adds that the cattle herders are sometimes armed with knives and other weapons. Experts say that herder and farmer disputes made worse by climate change have been linked to much of the insecurity in the Sahel in recent years. Yet many on both sides seem unaware of the effects climate change is having on their lives and instead look to God for solutions. He says they don't know what's causing the problems with the weather, but they definitely need rain. He says the community prays to God every day and asks him for water. That's all they can do. In recent years, the UN Security Council has begun to discuss how it can address climate change in the context of promoting stability. Janani Vivekananda, head of Programme for Climate Diplomacy and Security at Adelphi, a Berlin-based consultancy, points out the Council has yet to adopt a resolution outlining how it will deal with the problem. Recently, the Malian government asked the UN peacekeeping mission there to leave after it failed to reduce violence believed to be caused in part by global warming.
I think Mali is unfortunately an excellent example of how peacekeeping and stabilization forces has just not been fit for purpose, because the ways in which climate change affect the conflict, understanding those root causes of the conflict, climate change has been undermining already stressed livelihoods.
Experts say insecurity caused by climate change and fights over resources like water and land are likely to get worse. Florian Kramp is with the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute.
We have a very clear picture that a lot of security-related dynamics like riots, communal violence, are linked to the impacts of climate change. They are part of the story.
He went on to add, this is a today problem, and it's a problem that's going to be increasingly severe. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, N'Djamena, Chad.
South Africa's former President Jacob Zuma is in Russia, reportedly for medical treatment. His spokesman, Zwanele Manyi, today confirmed to South African news media that the 81-year-old Zuma went to Moscow last week and will return when his treatment is done. Yesterday, the Constitutional Court upheld a court ruling that Zuma should return to prison to complete a 15-month sentence for contempt of court. Prison authorities said they were studying the judgment and would seek legal advice on how to proceed. Zuma served as president between 2009 and 2018. His African National Congress Party forced him out over graft scandals. He was sentenced in June 2021 after refusing to testify before a panel probing allegations of graft under his tenure. He was then freed on medical parole just 2 months into his sentence. The former head of state last week attended a conference in Zimbabwe. The International Monetary Fund has urged the timely implementation of Zambia's landmark debt deal as it released $189 million. The move is part of a $1.3 billion three-year aid plan to the copper-rich nation. Zambia, with a total debt of $32.8 billion, defaulted on its $18.6 billion foreign debt in 2020 at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. Its foreign lenders agreed to restructure around a third of the country's debt last month following 2 years of tough negotiations. The IMF yesterday praised decisive steps that have been taken by Lusaka to slash inefficient public spending and boost social spending. It said Zambia's economy was starting to strengthen, with growth forecast to accelerate in 2024 and settle around 5% over the medium term. The body of a Democratic Republic of Congo opposition deputy was found riddled with bullets in the capital, Kinshasa, yesterday. Cherubin Okende was a former transport minister and a member of the party of Moise Katumbi, a leading opposition politician who is set to contest the presidential election in December. An official in Katumbi's team told the French news agency AFP that the 61-year-old Okende disappeared Wednesday. His body was found in his car on one of the city's main thoroughfares. A government spokesman tweeted that the government was shocked to learn of the assassination and that it had ordered a probe. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yabaro, and engineer, Carly Starling, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During a recent discussion in Washington, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the world is at an inflection point where current decisions will shape the future for decades. He noted that after a time of relative safety and prosperity following the end of the Cold War, major disruptors have appeared.
Obviously, the rise of China that has both the power and the intent to change the system that we're living in. A revanchist Russia that we're dealing with every single day. A panoply of interrelated and unfortunately mutually reinforcing transnational challenges, global challenges that we have to find a way to deal with effectively.
Those challenges include the proliferation of information systems with multiple unintended consequences, migration, food insecurity, climate change, threats to global health, the recession of democracy, and geopolitical competition.
We have a vision that is clear and unambiguous for what we'd like the world to become: free, secure, open, prosperous. It means countries that are free to decide what their path will be, who their partners will be. It means an international system that's built around rules, transparently, applied fairly and equitably, with goods, with information, with people flowing lawfully and freely.
On the other hand, Secretary Blinken said, we face countries wanting to erase any of the norms and standards that have led to prosperity in the last 75 years, countries which want to reassert spheres of influence and use predatory practices to gain economic power, which weaponize information and assert that universal human rights are purely internal matters. To counteract such a worldview, the United States is first investing in its own competitiveness. Second, it is working to reinvigorate its alliance and partnerships, such as NATO and partnerships in East Asia.
At the same time, we've also been building fit-for-purpose partnerships where different collections of countries, and not just countries, other stakeholders, other actors, the private sector, the non-governmental world, come together to try to tackle discrete problems.
When asked to describe the Biden doctrine, Secretary Blinken, who declared his resistance to doctrines in general, said, it starts with our strength at home, our competitiveness, with the investments we're making, and then it goes to making sure that we are strengthening and, as necessary, forging new alliances and new partnerships, because we can't do it alone.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.